Or what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States says it cannot yet confirm an airstrike last week in Syria killed a top Islamic State leader. A defense spokesman said a coalition airstrike near the town of al-Shadati targeted Georgian national Tarkan Betirishvili, also known as Abu Omar al-Shishani or Omar the Chechen. He's described as the IS Minister of War. Terrorism analyst Max Abrams of Northeastern University questions the value of taking out a so-called high-value target as a way of defeating the IS group.
Pro-government newspapers in
The United States.
The U.S. had a $5 million reward on the IS leader's head. The latest news follows reports last week of an airstrike near Aleppo that killed IS official Amir al-Absi, also known as Abu el-Athir. U.S. officials tell VOA they have not been able to confirm al-Absi's death. The U.S. government has added to the sanctions against the Lord's Resistance Army and the African rebel group's leader, Joseph Kony. The Treasury Department says the financial sanctions announced Tuesday are in response to the U.S. designated terrorist group's targeting of civilians in the Central African Republic. The department says that since December 2013, the group has killed, kidnapped, displaced, or committed sexual violence against hundreds of CAR residents, as well as looting or destroying civilian property. It also accused the group of trading in illicit diamonds and illegal elephant ivory in order to generate revenue. Kony is also wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes and crimes against humanity. This is VOA News. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden's arrival in Israel Tuesday was overshadowed by more violence involving Palestinian attackers. An American was stabbed to death, a dozen Israelis wounded, as a man ran down the boardwalk of the port city Jaffa, attacking people before being shot dead. A short distance away, Mr. Biden met with former Israeli President Shimon Peres, who condemned Tuesday's violence and said successful peace talks are the only answer.
Terror leads to nowhere, neither to the Arabs nor to us. And the Arabs and us, the majority of the people, know there is no alternative to the two-state solution, which was supported and initiated by you, and we shall follow with all our strength and dedication to make from it a new reality, a reality of peace and hope for all the people here.
The U.S. Vice President is set to meet Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu later Wednesday. A new public opinion survey released in Washington Tuesday shows nearly half Israeli Jews say Arabs should be expelled or transferred from Israel, according to a new survey. The poll released by the Pew Research Center found public opinion divided whether Israel can serve as a homeland for the country's Arab minority. In U.S. presidential politics, New York real estate developer Donald Trump added at least two more states to his column of Republican Party presidential primary victories, winning Mississippi and Michigan elections Tuesday.
This was an amazing evening, and to get these kind of numbers where they call them immediately is just something very special. So I want to thank the public. I want to thank the people of Michigan. I want to thank the people of Mississippi. And it is such a great honor.
On the Democratic side, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took Mississippi, but is in a tight race in Michigan with rival Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Voters also went to the polls in Idaho and Hawaii. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un claimed Wednesday on state-controlled media the North has successfully miniaturized nuclear warheads to be placed on intercontinental ballistic missiles. He emphasized their thermonuclear warheads. This follows earlier claims that Pyongyang's fourth nuclear test was a hydrogen weapon. Risk management consultant and former U.S. Air Force intelligence official Cedric Layton calls this a potentially ominous development.
If it is true that the North Koreans have actually miniaturized nuclear warheads, then this becomes a potential game changer for the countries not only in East Asia, but also for the countries in and around the Pacific Rim, and that includes the United States as well as Russia.
Layton says the Kim statement may be a reaction to recently expanded international sanctions approved by the UN Security Council. Nigeria and Switzerland Tuesday announced agreement to return more than $300 million in public funds stolen by the former military ruler Sani Abacha. The agreement came after a meeting in Abuja. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, March 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Jacob Zuma continues his visit to Nigeria today, Wednesday.
President Zuma is in Nigeria for a three-day state visit at the invitation of the Nigerian president. And of course, the idea to strengthen the relationship between the two leading African economies.
Galba Shehu is the special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. Somalia's government applauds a U.S. airstrike that killed about 150 Al-Shabaab militants. And a protest march today in Zimbabwe to commemorate 1 year since a pro-democracy activist went missing.
It's time for all youths to rise above partisan politics and indifference, because our future is certainly at stake.
Patson Zamora is the family representative for missing pro-democracy activist Itai Zamora. A new report says women wield too little political power globally. South Sudan says it is working to end child marriages. And a young South African musician gets praises for her fusion of tribal rhythms. Those stories plus Marco Uman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Jacob Zuma continues his three-day state visit to Nigeria today, Wednesday, at the invitation of President Muhammadu Buhari. The two countries are Africa's leading economies. Galba Shehu, special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity, says President Zuma's visit is intended to strengthen the relationship between the two nations, especially at a time when Nigeria is trying to diversify its economy from a dependence on oil to agriculture and mining. The two nations are also discussing security cooperation. On Tuesday, President Buhari accused the South African mobile phone company MTN of fueling the Boko Haram insurgency by its failure to disconnect unregistered users. Garba Shehu says the MTN was negligent even after repeated warnings from the Nigerian government.
President Zuma is in Nigeria for a three-day state visit at the invitation of the Nigerian president. And of course, the idea to strengthen the relationship between the two leading African economies, Nigeria being top and South Africa being the second largest economy. There's so much here to learn from each other, especially now that Nigeria wants to move from over dependence on oil, exploring possibilities in agriculture and mining. These are areas in which South Africa has achieved a lot of progress. We are discussing security, including arms manufacturing, and so on.
Your president, President Buhari, said on Tuesday that the South African mobile phone company, MTN, is helping Boko Haram. That's a heavy charge. Why did the president say that?
Well, I'm not sure he put it as tactfully as he did. What he said is that they were slow in carrying out the registration of their own subscribers. And by default, that, of course, has led to the usage of telecoms platforms by just anyone, including terrorists. And he said the implication of that is that the action of the company may have aided the killing by Boko Haram of more than 10,000 Nigerians.
Shehu, this story is somewhat like what's happening here in the United States, where the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, is asking Apple company to unlock an iPhone that was used by the gentleman and his wife who carried out the mass shootings in California. And Apple is saying that this is privacy. If it does that, many cell phones bought by individuals may also be a threat from government.
Well, I don't think the cases are as you put them, because in the case of the Nigerian incident, it is very clearly stated that each company must profile and register all of their subscribers. And the law clearly states that if you fail to register within a given deadline, you must be surcharged so much money for each individual that you did not register. So it's a law and order situation. The MTN was negligent in this exercise. Even after repeated warnings and deadline extensions, they simply ignored the government regulation.
Shehu, your government has fined MTN $3.9 billion for failing to disconnect these unregistered SIM cards. How is that going? Has the company paid?
No, they challenged the fine in court, and they on their own pulled the case out of the court, indicating their preparedness to sit down and negotiate. And the size of the fine, and I guess there was some remission of sorts. This thing had been cut by some percentage points because there's acceptance on their part. So they're talking to the government on how payment will be effected, and the government is on the table with them.
Garba Shehu is the special assistant to President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with me from Abuja. The Pentagon says a U.S. airstrike in central Somalia last Saturday killed more than 150 al-Shabaab militants who were preparing for a large-scale attack. Analysts say the strike was a major coup, but the African Union troops in Somalia still have a long fight ahead. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
In an interview with VOA, Somali presidential spokesman Dawood Awais applauded the airstrike. He says Somalia was aware of the strike and contributed intelligence.
We think that this was a significant victory not only for Somalia, but also for the entire region as we faced the same challenges in the war against terror. This was a coordinated attack in which Somali forces shared intelligence with their USA counterparts. These areas have been under close surveillance.
The training camp targeted is 190 kilometers north of Mogadishu. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis said the U.S. had learned the fighters were set to depart the camp and pose an imminent threat to African Union forces and U.S. military advisors in Somalia. An al-Shabaab spokesman, Abu Musab, confirmed the aerial attack but said the death toll was exaggerated. He says al-Shabaab does not gather more than 100 fighters in one place for security reasons. Analyst Yann Saint-Pierre, who runs the Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, says the opportunity for such a large strike may not come again.
Usually al-Shabaab, historically speaking, has always spread out its troops very well. So if this was indeed the case, that they had so many people in one location, it's a strategic mistake that they're definitely not bound to repeat.
Al-Shabaab has kept up a steady string of bombings against civilians in Mogadishu, while also going after African Union troops with renewed vigor since the middle of last year. On January 15th, al-Shabaab fighters stormed a Kenyan army camp in El Ade. In February, the Somali president said 200 soldiers lost their lives in that attack, a claim denied by the Kenyan government. Security observers say heavy losses in this and other recent raids are damaging the effectiveness and reputation of the African Union force, AMISOM. Analyst Saint-Pierre says airstrikes won't necessarily ease that pressure on ground troops.
Any American or Western support will be from the air, so they'll adjust their strategies accordingly while maintaining focus on the local troops. So the real message really needs to come from the AMISOM. It needs to come from the KDF. It needs to come from Somalia, much more than the Americans.
AMISOM has been fighting al-Shabaab in Somalia since 2007. The force currently has 22,000 men on the ground to provide assistance to the internationally recognized Somali government. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Today's Wednesday, March 9th. I'm James Botte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's Supreme Court on Tuesday granted permission to the family of missing pro-democracy activist Itai Zamara to hold a march today, Wednesday, to commemorate 1 year since the leader of Occupy Africa Unity Square was abducted by unknown assailants in Harare. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe program has details from the Zimbabwe capital.
The family approached the High Court after the police barred the planned march, arguing that it would infringe on other people's rights. Family lawyer Kenneth Masie told Studio 7 that Justice Clement Piri granted the order, saying it was the family's constitutional rights to demonstrate peacefully.
He cited that, in terms of the Constitution, Section 59, there was an unfettered right that was given to the citizens of Zimbabwe to petition and demonstrate. And, the only qualification there was that the demonstration should be peaceful. So basically that's what he insinuated in this judgment.
Family representative Patson Zamara told journalists the commemorations are meant to send a message to the government that forced disappearance should not persist in Zimbabwe. He said Zimbabweans, especially young people, must take a stand and make sure that disappearance stop, as anyone can become a victim.
It's time for all youths to rise above partisan politics and indifference, because our future is certainly at stake.
He said people are expected to gather at Africa Unity Square and then march peacefully along Jason Moyo to Rotten Row, Samora Machel, First Street, Nelson Mandela Avenue, and back to Africa Unity Square for prayers. Later in the day, a documentary and song to honor the missing activist, compiled by Patterson himself, will be unveiled at the Anglican Cathedral. Patterson Zamara said life without his brother has been very difficult, and the family is now struggling to cope, but remained hopeful that he would return one day.
Our emotions constantly oscillated between hope and despondence. Itai is still missing, and that is heart-rending.
Itai's wife, Shefra, said their two kids were equally worried and always asking about their father. Dick Frey, who worked with Itai Zamara in the Occupy Africa Unity Square project, said though work without the political activist had been very difficult, the group had re-strategized and was carrying on with his work. Itai Zamara Trust Chairperson Bishop Anselmo Magaya said it was disappointing that the government had failed to safeguard the life of Zimbabweans. He said developments in the ruling party indicate that no one is safe and some of the people who have been part of the state-alleged atrocities have been isolated.
It is now clear that no one in this country, no matter what office they occupy, is safe. Nobody is safe.
Although the family secured a high court order compelling the police and other security services to update the family on their investigations, Patterson Zamara and the family lawyer Kenneth Masia said police had not provided any lead so far. Police spokesperson, Senior Assistant Commissioner Charity Charamba, could not be reached for comment. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
As the world marked International Women's Day yesterday, Tuesday, a new report says women globally wield little political power, hampering efforts to bring about positive social and economic change for women. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the International Parliamentary Unions launched its Women in Parliament 2015, the Year in Review report.
The report finds women's participation in parliament has plateaued. For the second year in a row, the Interparliamentary Union says women have put in a disappointing showing. Last year, it notes, the number of women members of parliament increased by a low 0.5% in 58 national elections to reach 22.6% of women in parliament globally. At this snail's pace, IPU Director of Programs Karine Jabr says women will not reach the 2030 target for equality as set out in the Sustainable Development Goals. In contrast, she says, more progress has been made concerning women parliamentary leaders, with nearly 18% of parliaments today being led by women speakers, including three newcomers.
Nepal, which is quite emblematic after the adoption of the constitution in the country, Namibia and UAE being the first country to have Arab country to have a woman speaker of parliament.
The report finds Latin America, with more than 27% of women in parliament, has made the most progress, with sub-Saharan Africa not far behind. Though a number of elections in African countries were marred by violence and conflict, the IPU says women MPs have increased their numbers by 0.7% to reach 23.2%. Jabra says most progress has been made in Ethiopia and Tanzania due to quotas and other political incentives.
In Benin, we've noticed a very innovative campaign to encourage women, young women's political participation through social media. So this is also another interesting initiative that was noticed in Africa.
As in previous years, Rwanda has the highest proportion of female parliamentarians, with 65% of seats held by women. The IPU says overall, quotas remain one of the main tools for achieving progress in boosting the number of women MPs, but it adds quotas with teeth. It says sanctions must be applied and enforced where quota provisions are ignored. Otherwise, it warns, women will not be elected in large numbers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The government of South Sudan says it is working to end child marriages in the country. The Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Awud Deng Achul, says the government will enforce the age limit of 18 for marriage. Education Minister John Guy Yuao says his ministry is drafting a code of conduct which will impose a 7-year jail term for teachers who marry or impregnate underage girls. Gift Friday of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Hundreds of South Sudanese women sing the song, "This is the day that the Lord has made," as they mark International Women's Day. The day began with a procession from Juba town to Nyokron Cultural Center. Government officials, soldiers, and schoolgirls joined in the procession. Zainab Yassin is the chairperson of South Sudan's General Women Association. Yassin says the theme was chosen to pass a message to the South Sudanese people that early marriage must end in the country. She is asking the National Ministry of Education to create a platform for school administrators and parents to discuss the welfare of girls, especially the prevention of early child marriage. Speaking in Arabic, Yassin says girls from poor families are the most affected when it comes to child marriage.
During our time when we were young, the Ministry of Education made special considerations to children of farmers, children of widows, children of poor people, and children of soldiers. We need their children to study.
Edmund Yakani, the executive director of Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, which represents civil society organizations, is urging South Sudanese teachers to protect rather than abuse schoolgirls. Yakani says the state governments should adopt the girls' education bills. The chairperson of Specialized Committee for Gender in the National Assembly, Lydia Jock, says high poverty, traditional beliefs, conflict, instability, the low level of literacy, and gender gaps in education are all reasons for the rate of child marriage across South Sudan and other parts of Africa. She says many families marry off their daughters due to poverty. Jock describes this as a violation of girls' rights, which she says must end in order to ensure a brighter future for South Sudanese girls.
We must fight child marriage in South Sudan to bring it to an end by setting clearly a minimum age for marriage.
South Sudan's education minister, Dr. John Guy, agrees with Yakani that teachers are often responsible for the high dropout rate of girls in South Sudan. He says there's punitive punishment for people who abuse girls in schools. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Juba.
A young South African musician is winning accolades for her fusion of tribal rhythms from around the world. Courtney Gibson blends Western instruments like the electric guitar with traditional African instruments like the djembe drum and other indigenous instruments to create exceptional sounds. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Gibson says she uses instruments like the didgeridoo to mimic the sounds of Africa's animals, like the slow, violent growl of a lion on a nighttime hunt.
I try and pull those sounds into the didge, and the drums obviously help a lot because drums is part of Africa. The beat has got the rhythm of Africa and everything that we are.
Her love of Africa, its nature and its people, was inspired by her upbringing on a farm in the mountains of Mpumalanga province. Here, villagers taught her to make music using waste materials from a local dump.
I kind of picked up a pool pipe and started playing a pool pipe because I didn't have money for a didgeridoo, as us South Africans don't much have money, so.
As a child with pool pipe in mouth, Gibson dreamed of one day owning a real didgeridoo.
I just liked the sound, always liked the sound. I always found it had a nice tribal feel to it.
As Gibson has grown as a musician, so has her small collection of instruments, helping her create some of South Africa's most unique contemporary music. Gibson says no matter what she ever achieves as an artist, she'll never come close to her hero, the great South African folk singer and songwriter, Vusi Mahlasela.
Let's take this beer and put it right inside of this evil monster so we can learn to be free.
She recently saw Mahla Selah at a festival and approached him with a request.
Can I please play you a song? And he was kind of a bit shocked. He just said, okay, play it. And I played on his guitar. And it was the most amazing thing. Gave me a big hug afterwards.
Like Mahla Selah, Gibson makes music with a conscience. While most white South African musicians try to sound like American and British indie rock bands, Gibson's art remains firmly rooted in the bush of Mpumalanga.
I don't see why I should be something that I'm not. I'm African, I'm born here. My soul and everything inside me is African.
Many of her songs reflect her concern about the destruction of Africa's environment. Gibson says she doesn't want to be famous. She knows she'll never win awards playing what she calls her weird music. All that matters, she says, is that she's true to herself, true to Africa, and true to the rhythms alive inside her. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with wrestling. Hosts Egypt bagged 9 gold, 6 silver and 7 bronze medals to top the overall medal table at the Africa Wrestling Championships, which ended in Alexandria on Monday. Tunisia is second ahead of Nigeria. Algeria is fourth, followed by Senegal, Cameroon, Guinea-Bissau, South Africa, Morocco, Namibia and Chad. Tunisia prevailed in the men's freestyle wrestling, with Egypt second ahead of Nigeria, while Nigeria carried the day in the women's freestyle wrestling, with Tunisia second ahead of Egypt. Egypt dominated the Greco-Roman event. Algeria were runners-up and Morocco placed third. Meanwhile, the East Africa Secondary School Sports Association Games President Justus Mugisha confirmed to the media in Kampala, Uganda on Monday that this year's regional sports event will be staged in Eldoret in Western Kenya. The week-long event, which features teams from Burundi, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, Zanzibar and hosts Kenya, will start on the 26th of August. Turning to football, disgraced former FIFA Vice President Michel Platini has filed an appeal with the Court of Arbitration for Sports against FIFA's 6-year ban from all football activities, the Court of Arbitration for Sports revealed in Lausanne, Switzerland. According to FIFA's Ethics Committee and FIFA's Appeals Committee, Platini and former FIFA President Sepp Blatter attracted the sanction following a breach of the FIFA Code of Ethics. Finally, hosts Togo pipped Ghana by a solitary goal in a friendly match played in Lome over the weekend. Both sides fielded teams composed of home-based players. Both teams are preparing for the Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers later this month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Niger's opposition coalition announced Tuesday that it is dropping out of this month's presidential election runoff, calling the entire system unfair. The Coalition for Political Change in Niger, known as COPA, denounced the results of the first round, won by incumbent President Mahamadou Issoufou, as grotesque and cooked up. It says its candidate, Amadou, will not participate in the second round on March 20th. That's it for this Wednesday, March 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, I'm James Barton in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.